All Rise, the Pushka Family Trial.
With Frank Graney.
A News Talk original podcast.
A jury has been told Josef Pushka's two brothers are accused of misleading a Gardaí. His brothers Marek and Lubomir have pleaded not guilty to withholding information from Gardaí, while their wives deny assisting Josef Pushka.
The jury in the trial of four members of Josef Pushka's family has been sent home for the weekend, having deliberated for over 7 hours this week.
Josef Pushka's brothers Marek and Lubomir have been found guilty of withholding information from Gardaí during the investigation into Aisling Murphy's murder. Their wives have also been convicted of assisting their brother-in-law by burning the clothes he was wearing when he murdered the 23-year-old schoolteacher in 2022.
On the afternoon of the 12th of January 2022, Aisling Murphy, a 23-year-old schoolteacher, was killed while exercising along the banks of the Grand Canal in Tullamore.
And after a lengthy trial the following year, Josef Pushka, a 35-year-old Slovakian man, was found guilty of her murder and handed a life sentence.
I'm Frank Graney, courts correspondent for News Talk.
And I'm Aisling Moore, radio producer.
And here we're going to talk about the sentencing of five of Pushka's family members, his wife, two brothers and their wives.
Each of them played a role in trying to cover up what Josef Pushka did by either withholding information from Gardaí or destroying evidence.
We'll also hear what Aisling's family had to say about their crimes on what was yet another difficult day in court for them.
This is All Rise, the Pushka family trial. So Frank, we'll get to the sentences in a moment, but before we do, you might just remind us what each of the accused did.
Well, these charges flowed from the investigation into the murder of Aisling Murphy. As we all know, she was brutally, savagely murdered by Josef Pushka while out walking along the Grand Canal in Tullamore. I should say they were not known to each other. I'm at pains to say that whenever we talk about this story, because there were some disgusting rumours circulating online. There's no need to go into them now about their connection. They were not known to each other. It was a completely unprovoked attack in broad daylight by a man who had spent the day following random women around Tullamore on his bike. A couple of joggers raised the alarm after spotting a woman being attacked in some bushes just off the towpath. By the time first responders arrived, Josef Pushka had already fled, scrambling through some thick brambles. He then waited for nightfall in some nearby fields before making his way to a friend's house. From there, he got a lift home to Mukla. He arrived there at about 9 o'clock that evening, some 5.5 hours after he killed Aisling. He was soaking wet. He was covered in cuts from the brambles. And at the time, in that house in Mukla, he was living with his wife and their kids. His two brothers also lived there, Marek and Lubomir Pushka, their wives, Josefina Grunzova and Viera Gatsiova, and their kids. So in all, there were 6 adults and 14 kids living in that house in Mukla. And by the time he returned home, as I say, 5.5 hours after he had killed Aisling, a massive manhunt was underway for Aisling's killer. So what did his family do? Well, let's start with Josef Pushka's wife, Lucia. In her initial dealings with Gardaí, she didn't say anything about her husband returning home that night to their house in Mukla with visible injuries. She also didn't reveal that he subsequently travelled to Dublin with his parents. And when asked by Gardaí if her husband owned the bike, you may remember this bike, it was a very distinctive Falcon bike. And at the time of the murder, Gardaí had sent around photographs of it, looking for information in relation to that. So she was shown, and these were voluntary statements that she was given to Gardaí in the days after the murder. And she was shown that famous or infamous picture of that very distinctive bike. And she was asked if her husband owned it, because that bike was found very close to the crime scene. And she said that he didn't have a bike like that. So that was clearly a lie. Crucially, she also failed to mention that Josef told her that he had injured a woman with a knife. In relation to his brothers then, Marek and Lubomir Pushka, like Lucia, they also withheld information about their brother's whereabouts and his movements on the night in question. Josef had also made certain admissions to them, which they didn't disclose to Gardaí. Marek was aware of a plan to burn Josef Pushka's clothes, the clothes he was wearing when he killed Aisling Murphy. But again, that was something that he didn't tell the guards about.
And it was the burning of those clothes that brought Marek and Lubomir's wives into the picture.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose given the nature of the frenzied attack on Aisling Murphy, you'd have to assume that his clothes would have been significant in terms of forensic evidence. I mean, Aisling had what were described in court as 12 sharp knife-like wounds, 11 stab wounds to the neck. His clothes were blood-stained, but they were never recovered because Josefina Grunzova and Vera Gatsiova destroyed them, and they did so by burning the clothes in the fireplace of their home in Mukla. We don't know when exactly they burned the clothes, but it was most likely within a day or two of the murder, because the house was searched 2 days after Aisling's murder, and there was no trace of the clothes. Clearly, that was something that they would have been looking for. The order to destroy the clothes was said to have come from Dublin after Josef Puska travelled there in the early hours of the 13th of January 2022 to stay with his parents. During the Garda interviews we heard during the trial, Marek told detectives that he and Lubomir decided to get the girls to burn the clothes so the guards couldn't find him. The judge accepted that this was a collective family decision, not an impulsive act by the two women. And it was a thorough job too, because as I say, when Gardaí later searched that fireplace, they found absolutely no trace of the clothes. And there are certain elements of clothing which, when burnt, things like zips or like laces, like metal eyelets, things like that, that you'd still expect to find in a fireplace. But Vera Gatsiova had gathered up the ashes and washed them down the sink. So it was a thorough job, and Gardaí were not able to find any trace of clothes, thereby robbing them of potential crucial forensic evidence. Mm.
Did they offer any explanation as to why they did it? They must have known what they were doing was wrong.
Yeah, well, I think Marek's wife, Josefina Grunzova, summed it up nicely when she told the guards they were told to do it, so they did it. That was her simple explanation. They absolutely had to have known what they were doing was wrong. As I say, the clothes were covered in blood. Josef Puska had returned home on the night of the murder with visible injuries. He had confessed. We had a confession to his brothers, their husbands. And as I say, the clothes were covered in blood. Now, they say that while they were told about these confessions, they didn't believe that Josef was capable of doing something like that. And that was something that was put forward in their defence during the trial. But something the psychological reports threw up, and these would have been prepared in advance of the sentence hearing, and something that they threw up gave the judge some pause for thought. The judge, in this case, Ms. Justice Caroline Biggs, did spend some time thinking about this, and it was a reference to the relationship between man and woman in Roma culture, between a man and his wife. The judge was told in those relationships, women are subordinate. They're subordinate within the family structure. And while there was no attempt to coerce or intimidate the women, the reports suggested that the men didn't have to. That cultural difference was something also offered up in submissions made by their defence lawyers at an earlier sentence hearing. And it weighed heavily on the judge. She wondered if their culture affected their decision-making. She felt it was a feature that she couldn't ignore. The women also claimed that they were scared to tell the truth, and that was offered as an explanation as to why they initially didn't come clean when they met with Gardaí. And while the judge did note their fear and their family loyalty were real, she said those factors didn't absolve them of responsibility.
And did Lucia offer a similar plea in mitigation? And then what about the brothers? How did they try to convince the judge to be as lenient as possible?
Well, Lucia made the best case in terms of mitigation. She had the best case because, unlike the others, she had pleaded guilty. Mm. So she had admitted wrongdoing. However, that plea came very late. That came at the end of a lengthy pre-trial hearing. Mm. This would have been before a jury was sworn in. We wouldn't have been in a position to report it.
I remember
at
that.
The time.
Yeah, that it was known within the court, shall we say, but it can't have been publicised.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pre-trial hearings were introduced a few years ago to great effect, I must say, to, I suppose, make the trial process more efficient. So during any type of a criminal trial, more often than not, there are times where the jury is excused, asked to leave while legal issues are thrashed out in their absence. And that can delay matters. They can go on for days, weeks, sometimes longer in high-profile trials. So what these pre-trial hearings do very well is they anticipate those legal issues. They're thrashed out before a jury is even sworn in. Mm. Now, the pre-trial hearing in relation to this case affected Lucia's case mostly. She was trying to get a lot of evidence thrown out and was largely unsuccessful. So on the back of that, I mean, we won't know about consultations, obviously, private consultations that she had with her lawyers. But on the back of that, one would suspect that she looked at the case and thought, okay, you know, there is a strong chance of a conviction here. Perhaps, again, I'm just speculating, we don't know for sure. But in any event, she changed her plea to guilty. Now, that was at a very late stage. That was at the 11th hour, just before a jury was to be sworn in. If she had pleaded at an earlier stage, she would have been entitled to a much greater discount. So by admitting wrongdoing at an early stage, it saves the ordeal of a trial. It saves a family having been re-traumatised by evidence heard during a trial. And an accused person is given maybe a 20-25% discount. Lucia only got a 10% discount. So she did get a discount for the early plea, for the plea, but the fact that it didn't come earlier, she didn't get the full benefit of that discount. So it was a limited credit. Also in mitigation, Lucia was described as a devoted mother of five children, a person of otherwise good character. She, like the others, has no previous convictions. Her defence said that she acted under emotional strain. She believed she was acting in the best interests of her children. Various reports handed up on her behalf also. There was one from a probation report. And that was interesting because despite the fact that she had pleaded guilty, as I've said, that probation officer had some concerns about her acceptance of wrongdoing, that there was an element of denial of wrongdoing at first. Now, there was a psychological report prepared separately, and that did maybe shed some light, her defence at least argued, on the probation officer's findings, because the psychologist felt that she found it, Lucia that is, finds it hard to express emotion. Her behaviour reflected shock, confusion, dependency rather than malice. So these were all things that were put forward to the judge in an effort to, I suppose, reduce the sentence. Her relationship with her husband, Josef Puszka, was described as close but controlling, and her decisions were said to have been influenced by that dynamic. Marek's lawyers then claimed that he acted out of misguided loyalty to his brother, not malice, not profit. His actions were described as those of a man trying to protect a family member in the midst of high emotional turmoil. His defence said he was highly stressed. He was panicked in the aftermath of the killing. Again, he has no previous convictions. And his barrister argued that while he wasn't very cooperative, in fact, he may have misled Gardaí initially by not disclosing certain crucial information, he did later cooperate with the investigation team, and the judge was asked to view that as an effort to set the record straight. Again, in relation to Lubomir, who was also convicted of that charge of withholding information, his barristers claimed his actions stemmed from family loyalty, not a desire to obstruct justice. And like Marek and Lucia and the others, no previous convictions there. He too had been bail compliant throughout proceedings, and ultimately, like his brother, had eventually provided information that allowed the case to progress.
All of those pleas in mitigation were made at their sentence hearing earlier this month, but the judge had one more thing to consider before she moved to sentencing, and that was how their crimes have affected Aisling's family.
Yeah, that's right. And they were all there again for the sentencing. Aisling's parents, Ray and Kathleen, her sister Amy, brother Cahill, Aisling's boyfriend Ryan Casey there too, as well as many other family members. They were there throughout this trial, as they were during Josef Puszka's murder trial. And two victim impact statements were delivered to the court. The first was read out by Detective Garda Alan Burke on behalf of Aisling's father, Ray. And just like she did at Josef Puszka's sentence hearing, Amy also read out her own victim impact statement.
Well, I think just like we did during the murder trial, it's only appropriate that we read those statements out word for word in full. Mm. So, Frank, maybe you would start and you'd read Ray's statement now, and then I will look after Amy's.
Yeah, and I think this is the right thing to do, because you can just imagine how difficult it was for Ray and for Amy to sit down and put their thoughts and feelings to paper. And I don't think we should leave a single word out. Mm. And Ray, actually, after the hearing, Ray kindly came up to me, the the journalists that were covering this case, you can imagine there was a lot of media interest. We were allowed to sit in the jury box to allow for more room, I suppose, in the body of the court for family members and whatnot. And Ray came up to me afterwards and handed me hard copies of his victim impact statement and also of Amy's victim impact statement. So
great.
I'll read out Ray's. And as I say, this was delivered yesterday by Detective Garda Alan Burke. And it goes as follows. On the 6th of July, 1998, our beautiful little girl, Aisling, was born in the maternity ward of Ballinasloe Hospital. From day one, she was never a crying child and always had a smile on her beautiful face, full of love, laughter and joyous giggles. From a very early age, she always showed a lot of interest in music and in particular, the tin whistle. When Aisling was 3 years old, Santa brought her a little pink plastic fiddle for Christmas. She absolutely adored it because it actually played nursery rhymes. And from this, her love of the fiddle grew. That pink toy fiddle is still in her bedroom now as I sit here writing this. Aisling always told me that she intended to give that toy fiddle she cherished so much as a child to her own children one day, so they too could play with it and find a love of music. But that will never happen now. It will forever remain in her bedroom, frozen in time, and unplayed by children Aisling can never have. Because of Aisling and Amy's talent for traditional Irish music, we were very fortunate to have the opportunities to visit places we might never have seen otherwise, and I will cherish these memories forever. Aisling was always in a hurry to help someone else. It could be music classes, or just meeting friends for a tune, or going to and from a match or play. In our home, Aisling was always the organiser. Whatever was on, Aisling would organise it down to the very last detail, giving out instructions for the rest of the family. On a Sunday morning, we would always get 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. mass. Aisling could have three or four lessons on her fiddle with students who couldn't make the class on Saturday. After mass, she would pack up for the week and drive to Dublin in her granddad's little red Seat Cordova to practice orchestra, then back to Limerick to Mary Eye College. But she'd always still make time for her mum and dad. Aisling conducted music lessons in our front room every Friday evening and again on Saturday mornings and afternoons. It was a joy to hear all the lovely music from tin whistles and fiddles radiate throughout the house, and I often enjoyed the chats with the children's parents. All that is gone now. There is no more music in our house anymore. On the 11th of January, 2022, the evening before her murder, Aisling and I were watching a film on television. It was On Her Majesty's Secret Service. The film has a beautiful soundtrack which includes a timeless tune by the great Louis Armstrong titled We Have All the Time in the World. Aisling thought this piece of music, this melody, was absolutely beautiful. And before the film was over, Aisling had converted the melody into music for her fiddle with the intention of learning to play it herself. It breaks my heart that I'll never hear it. We all miss Aisling so much. Her loss to us can never be measured, not emotionally, not physically, not financially. She can never be replaced. The loss of Aisling could never be properly described. Her lovely, cheery voice and beautiful smile filled our days with such joy and happiness. It was a privilege for our family to be blessed with such a kind, talented and beautiful daughter. She is the first thought that comes to my mind each morning and my last thought before I close my eyes every night. The pain and suffering we are cursed to suffer every day is literally a life sentence, one from which there are no appeals, no paroles, and which no barrister or judge can free us. This inescapable life sentence was handed down to all of us by the monster that is Josef Puszka. No matter what little suffering he or his family members endure as a result of his unspeakable actions on the 12th of January 2022. It will never compare to the inescapable nightmare my family and I find ourselves in. The small consolation we have is that Josef Puszka now rots in prison, isolated and alone, having been found guilty of the murder of my beautiful girl. But even this would have been robbed from us if these five members of his family here before the court had succeeded in their attempts to withhold vital information and to destroy crucial evidence in the murder of our daughter. At 6:30 on the evening of the 12th of January 2022, our world changed forever. That's the moment when detectives from Tullamore Garda Station arrived at our home to break the terrible news that our lovely Aisling was dead. Brutally murdered in cold blood by the coward that is Josef Puszka. The name Puszka has become a nightmare to our family. Every day sitting in court, day after day, week after week, listening to the horrors that were inflicted on Aisling was absolutely unbearable and something from which we will never recover. These wounds were ripped open again 2 years later when we returned for the trial of his family members. A trial which could have been avoided if her family had simply done the right thing and for once thought of others instead of themselves, as appears to always be the case. We may even have been spared the trauma of a murder trial, of having to endure the detailed horrors of what was inflicted upon our Aisling if any of these five people had come forward with what they knew in January 2022. Instead, they closed ranks and decided to protect the animal they called their husband and brother. One thing I have come to realise through all of this is what our beautiful Aisling has come to represent to so many people around the world. She represents the best of everything Ireland is. She represents beauty and kindness, compassion and talent, love and innocence. This will forever be her legacy. I ask the Puszka family sitting here today, what is your legacy? What will you all be remembered for when your time finally comes? A family who came to our great country in search of a better life, but built that life on a strong foundation of taking, not giving. A family who benefited greatly from everything our little nation offers to those in need while contributing absolutely nothing in return. A family who knew, without question, that one of their own had gone out onto the streets of Tullamore and murdered our beautiful girl in the most horrific way imaginable. And instead of doing what was right, instead of doing the honourable thing by coming forward and telling Gardaí what you knew, you instead did everything possible to conceal what you knew and to destroy vital evidence in the hopes that my family would be left without justice and closure for the rest of our lives, while your husband and brother would be left free to roam the streets of Ireland to possibly do this all over again to another innocent family. The hurt your actions have caused us can never be undone. And I pray that today you all, like Josef Puszka, receive the lengthy custodial sentences you so richly deserve.
Wow.
There are no words, really. I mean, that was Ray's statement. Wonderfully delivered, I must say, by Detective Garda Alan Burke, who has been a huge support to the family throughout this horrendous ordeal. I felt, listening to that, and you could hear a pin drop, and I really felt that his words gave us all such a wonderful insight into the special bond that he had with Aisling. He clearly adored her, is absolutely devastated by her loss. But he also let his feelings be known in relation to Josef Puszka, describing him, as we heard, as a monster, and he condemned the others for trying to shield Josef Puszka from justice. And once that statement was delivered, then Amy made that trip back into the witness box to deliver her own victim impact statement, just like she did when Josef Puszka was seated in the dock behind her.
This is Amy's statement. Delivering my victim impact statement during the main murder trial in 2023 had a profound and lasting effect on my well-being. The thought of returning to court to do so again today filled me with dread, And yet, I stand here because it is essential that Aisling is represented and that our family's voice is finally heard before any decision is made regarding the future of these defendants. We have been assured by the prosecution team that Justice Caroline Biggs will approach this sentencing with fairness, care and thoughtful deliberation, weighing every consideration from both sides with the seriousness it deserves. Yet, throughout this process, our family's perspective has rarely been heard. The court has listened time and time again of the defendant's narrative, while those who loved Aisling have had few opportunities to speak on her behalf or to convey the true depth of our pain and loss. Legal proceedings are not and never will be victim-focused, and that imbalance must be acknowledged today. Though revisiting these events comes at a great personal cost, I do so because our perspective and Aisling's memory must finally be given the weight it truly deserves. To start, I want to talk about Aisling, who she was and everything that made her so special. But the truth is, my memories of her are so deeply personal. They're private, they're the most precious things I have left of her. They're all I have that still feel like mine. These court cases have already taken so much from me, from our whole family, and I can't bring myself to give any more of those memories away. They belong to us, Aisling and I. For that very reason, I have chosen to use the exact words I wrote in my victim impact statement during the main murder trial in 2023. Those words come straight from my heart, and they still hold every bit of truth, love and pain that I carry for her today. Although Aisling was the youngest, there was no doubt that she was everyone's role model. Every day, Aisling would bounce in the door asking, "How are we?" wearing her big, friendly smile and beaming with positivity. She had such an endearing personality and was so generous with her time, her love, her talents, giving so much of herself to others. Musicians of all ages were welcomed into our home every week to learn and absorb Aisling's talent and passion for music and listen to her stories, hanging on to her every word. As our young Aisling grew up, she became the glue that bound our tightly knit family together. Taking after Mam, there was a warm smile. After Dad, a cheeky wit and wink. Aisling brought the best out of us. Our parents instilled a strong work ethic in Aisling, and she knew the value of a pound. They taught her that nothing is handed to you in this life, and if you wanted something, you would have to earn it, and that she did. Like many young ladies, Aisling took pride in her appearance and loved her style. For Aisling, shopping could only be described as a competitive sport, which of course she took first place in. She quite literally could have bought shares in Zara. The week of her death saw multiple delivery drivers arrive at our door with tears in their eyes, handing over yet another parcel with Aisling's name on it. Those online shopping deliveries still sit on her bed today, unopened. Aisling was a vibrant, outgoing 23-year-old just merely starting out in her career as a primary school teacher. She had just graduated less than 3 months previous, and the world was her oyster. All her hard work up to this point had paid off, and she was reaping the rewards of life. Aisling was born to be a teacher and loved every second of it, be that in a school classroom or in her music lessons. She personified all the qualities any mother or father would want in their child's teacher. Ms. Murphy had 28 first-class students and was like a second mammy to them, always going above and beyond to make sure they met their full potential and enjoyed school life. There were many evenings Aisling got delayed leaving school as she pondered over the most creative elf-on-the-shelf ideas that she knew would bring so much joy to the children. She awaited their reaction each morning, knowing the excitement it brought to their classroom. As a surprise, she baked gingerbread men for each and every one of them at Christmas. Her baking supplies now sit untouched in the press at home. She immersed herself in all things the school life had to offer, helping out with the school choir and music groups whenever she could, always encouraging the children with genuine affection and enthusiasm. It breaks our hearts that she was stolen from the many wonderful students she had an impact on, who are now left brokenhearted at her sudden departure, a void which cannot be filled. When Aisling wasn't in school, she was clocking miles in her granddad's red car, a car which she drove with such pride as she inherited it after her beloved granddad passed away. She had a very special bond with him, and on his last Christmas, he gifted her a pink woolly hat with a bauble on top. Both her red car and her pink woolly hat were repeatedly referenced throughout the evidence given in this case. After a period of time following Aisling's murder, we eventually got her car back. My heart sank when I opened the front passenger door to find a half-eaten slice of toast and a half-drunk mug of tea, along with her handbag, teaching supplies, and a hurl sitting in the front seat. All signs of a young woman preoccupied with the comings and goings of her busy, everyday life. What might seem like chaos to many, a normal weekend for Aisling regularly included teaching music lessons, gigging, camogie matches, working in a local restaurant, or driving to Dublin for orchestra rehearsals. She juggled 101 tasks effortlessly with a smile on her face. I see so many similarities between Aisling and our mother. They are both kind, gentle, and great listeners. I have no doubt Aisling would have been an exceptional mother too. Children were at the forefront of her everyday life, and she had so much love to give them. Our lives were enormously enriched because of Aisling. She was charismatic, compassionate, and her infectious laugh could light up any room. As siblings do, she could roast myself or Cahill with some of her best one-liners. However, she never sought to be the centre of attention. She had the ability to strike up a conversation with anyone, irrespective of their age, and made them feel like they genuinely had a friend in her. Her zest for life was palpable to anybody that was in her company. She did so much for absolutely everyone, yet no one was there when she needed them most, including her family. We would have done anything to be there by her side to protect her, hold her hand, and catch her tears. Aisling excelled in every aspect of her life, yet remained incredibly humble. She embodied many of the great traits and qualities of the Irish people through music, teaching, GAA, agus an teanga Gaeilge. Her life had a huge impact on so many of those around her, and she was the epitome of a perfect role model for every little girl to aspire to be. She was not only an integral part of our family, but was also a huge shining light in our community. A community in which she, year in, year out, gave back to in every way she could. This country has lost someone who made a difference. At any given hour of any given day, we could be found gathered round the kitchen table, Aisling and I. With our instruments in hand and the instrument cases thrown under the table, we would spend hours learning, listening, and practicing together. Music is not and will never be the same without Aisling. Our love for Irish music was intertwined with our special bond. We could read each other's mind when we played together. Each wink and smile she sent my way as her fingers created something beautiful beyond sound was her connection, our connection together. Something that we had such a passion for and spent so much of our time doing is completely and irreparably destroyed. I miss her vibrant fiddle playing so much and the sheer joy it brought her. Aisling's pink fiddle case now lies at home covered in dust. For me, this serves as the harshest and cruelest reminder we will never play together again and of how fragile this life truly is. Moonthor, teacher, daughter, partner and friend, all accomplished before the tender age of 23. She had learned more in those few short years than most learn in their lifetime, and not in the academic sense. She valued those most important to her and chose a career that brought so much meaning to her life. Aisling's legacy of love, giving and caring will live on, but that bears little comfort to us. We want her here, safe in our arms today. Our family has suffered an immeasurable loss. The life of an innocent, cherished loved one was taken from us, and the void she left behind can never be filled. The defendants, in choosing to assist the man responsible, demonstrated a profound disregard for Aisling's life and the pain their actions would cause. We ask that this gravity of loss and the consequences of their deliberate choices be fully recognised. We understand that the defendants have children, but that cannot be used as a reason for leniency. Being a parent should come with the responsibility of setting an example of honesty, integrity and respect for the law. In this case, the defendants did the opposite. They chose to pervert the course of justice. Being a parent should not be a shield from accountability. Losing my sister and sitting through this trial has brought every imaginable emotion, grief, disbelief and profound sadness. But the most persistent, most consuming emotion has been anger. Anger at the injustice of it all and at the enormous public cost of these proceedings. This trial began on the 28th of April and only now, months later, is drawing to a close. The time, resources and taxpayer money consumed are staggering. Multiple legal teams, endless delays and years of public expense. It is deeply frustrating to know how much of that could have been directed towards vital and underfunded services across Ireland. That frustration is not mine alone. It is shared by countless hardworking people who contribute honestly to this country. And although we've already lost so much, it feels as if the system keeps taking more. 2 weeks ago, it felt as though our family was being gaslit by all five of the defendants' senior counsel. Listening to the defence repeatedly speak about their clients' supposed values, about the importance of family, education, and wanting a better life for their children was beyond hurtful. How dare they speak those words? Words they clearly don't live by and that their actions completely contradict. Our parents worked incredibly hard to provide for us, to ensure we were educated and to instill in us a strong work ethic, integrity and moral responsibility. To sit there and hear those values twisted and used in defence of people who have demonstrated none of those qualities was infuriating. It felt deeply insulting to Aisling, to our parents and to everything decent families stand for. Since losing Aisling, I have thrown myself into work, often clocking 90-hour weeks because it's the only thing that keeps me going. Work has become my only coping mechanism, my only means of survival. It gives me structure when everything else feels lost, allowing me, for a little while, to silence the constant pain and keep moving forward. My job has taught me to compartmentalise, to bury the hardest emotions deep down, just to make it through each day. Grief doesn't fade. It simply hides behind the noise and exhaustion of working long hours. The year Aisling was murdered, I enrolled in my master's. Not because I had the strength, but because keeping busy was the only thing to stop my mind from collapsing under the weight of it all. Losing my sister is the hardest thing I will ever endure. No counsellor, no programme, no words of comfort can take away the grief I carry every day. If I had the choice, I would have been in court every single day of this trial to represent Aisling and bear witness on her behalf. But I couldn't. Like so many others, I couldn't step away from my responsibilities. I had to keep showing up for work and for life. That commitment has been my anchor, offering a sense of purpose, even in the face of profound loss. That's something these defendants seem to know nothing about. They have shown little sense of accountability for their actions, nor do they demonstrate any responsibility in their own lives. The kind of everyday duty that most people in this country uphold through honest work and contribution. 2 weeks ago, psychological reports were repeatedly referenced in court, stating that there is historically an expectation on men to provide economically in the Roma culture. We also heard that both Lubomir and Marek worked in construction in Slovakia and the Czech Republic. Yet after moving to Ireland in 2013, they never joined the workforce. Why is that? These five defendants obstructed justice by lying to the Gardaí, destroying evidence and withholding information. It was not accidental. They were deliberate in their choices. They each chose silent complicity, proving themselves to be unreliable and untrustworthy when truth and courage were most needed. Aisling's absence has changed the rhythm of our entire family. Every gathering, every birthday, every simple, everyday moment feels incomplete without her. We all grieve differently, but the loss binds us in a shared silence that never truly lifts. My parents have lost a part of themselves. The light in their eyes has dimmed in a way that can never be restored. The music that once filled our home has been replaced by an eerie silence that is deafening. When we try to move forward, we find ourselves pulled back by memories of who she was and everything she was meant to be. Her loss isn't something we will ever get over. It is something we now live alongside every day for the rest of our lives. As this process draws to a close, I want to make it clear that our family does not accept any expressions of sympathy offered by the defendants for Aisling's loss. Their words carry no sincerity and meaning when measured against their actions. True remorse is proven through action, not empty statements. Aisling's absence is permanent. It has stripped our lives of joy, colour, and meaning. What's left is survival, nothing more.
A remarkable statement again from
unbelievably
Amy. Like, to do that first time round must have been traumatic enough. To do it again,
a second time.
And I suppose from just reading it out like that, what's maybe lost is, I suppose, how she was in the witness box delivering that statement, and you know, having to walk past all five of the defendants sitting in the dock. Not an easy thing to do. She's a remarkably strong woman. And also at various points, she turned around. So the witness box is very close to the dock. In fact, if she was to look over her right shoulder, she would see everyone seated there in the dock. And she did that a number of times. And she spoke to them directly, which I thought was incredibly brave and really, really
strength.
Powerful.
The strength to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, once those statements were read into the court, the judge then started delivering her reasoning behind the sentences handed down.
Yeah, and I suppose clearly Ms. Justice Biggs had an awful lot to consider in terms of the facts of the case, the pleas and mitigation, and of course those really powerful victim impact statements. And in terms of maximum penalty, so Lucia, Marek and Lubomir faced up to 5 years in prison for that charge, that conviction for withholding information. Josefina and Vieira then, they were found guilty of a different offence, that of assisting an offender by burning the clothes, destroying evidence. That's a very serious offence that could land a person in prison for up to 10 years. So what the judge had to do, I suppose, initially was manage expectations, because clearly you had Ray and Amy and the wider Murphy family looking, understandably, for justice and for lengthy sentences for what they did, trying to cover up Aisling's killer, trying to help him to get away with it. So that was very understandable. But what Ms. Biggs did was she just outlined that, look, sentencing isn't an act of vengeance. It is a complicated area of law. Lots of things have to be balanced. You have to look at the offence, absolutely, a person's culpability. But you also have to look at the offender, all of the surrounding circumstances, mitigation, their otherwise good characters put forward in their pleas in mitigation. And she took some time yesterday going through all of that. I mean, when she said that it wasn't an act of vengeance, sentencing, that is, she said that sentences had to be proportionate. They had to take into account the level of culpability of each of the accused and, as I say, the individual mitigating factors. And she placed their culpability at the mid-range on this scale of seriousness. So there were obviously different levels of seriousness for an offence, and she felt that this was not in the upper end. And her reasoning for doing that was because their actions didn't actually hinder the investigation or prosecution. Josef Puszka was caught, he was arrested, he was charged, and he was successfully prosecuted and convicted for Aisling's murder. It would have been a different case if he had completely evaded justice, and they were responsible for helping him in doing so. Now, she did accept that a collective decision was made to withhold information, that the family essentially closed ranks, which I think was a comment that Ray made in his victim impact statement to protect Josef Puszka. But at the end of the day, as I say, he was caught, he was brought to justice. Even the burning of the clothes didn't derail the investigation. And that, I suppose that's largely down to the huge body of evidence that the investigation team had without it. She took all of the mitigating factors into account, the otherwise clean records, bail compliance, low risk of reoffending, They've all ultimately accepted the verdicts, their family circumstances, the fact there are 14 dependent children now who won't have any parents to look after them while they're in custody, and the hardship in custody that, I suppose, is not going to affect it at all to that. She accepted the evidence that the women were subordinate within the family structure and that they acted on instruction. And that feature actually justified, she felt, suspending 6 months of each woman's term. So that was interesting. And obviously, you had Lucia Istakova's guilty plea. She was given extra credit for that, albeit limited, as we've explained earlier. So in the end, the two brothers got the longest sentences. They reached jail for 2.5 years. Lucia got the lightest sentence. She was jailed for 20 months. And I suppose that was a nod to the guilty plea. And when it came to the destruction of the clothes, Vera Gatsiova was considered to be more culpable than Josefina Grunzova. So she got 2 years, while Josefina was sentenced to 21 months.
And at that stage, they were taken into custody for the first time to serve their sentences. Do we know if any of them are likely to appeal, or could this have been the last time that Aisling's family will have to endure another difficult day in court?
It's a great question. I mean, Lucia can't appeal her conviction because she admitted her guilt. The other four have already indicated that they won't be appealing their conviction. So I suppose the only avenue of appeal for these five defendants would be if they felt the sentences handed down were too harsh. But to be honest, I can't see how they would make that argument. So appeals unlikely in relation to this case. But let's not forget that Josef Puszka, the reason they were all there, the reason that the Murphy family have been dragged into court in these dreadful circumstances, he has already indicated his intention to appeal that murder conviction. A date for that appeal has yet to be set, but you can almost guarantee that no matter how difficult that will be, Aisling's family will once again be there sitting in the public gallery with the same quiet dignity that they have observed throughout all of these dreadful proceedings. As Amy put it in her victim impact statement, it is essential that Aisling is represented. Her family will never get over what happened. And sadly, no judge, no conviction will ever bring Aisling back. But hopefully, seeing justice being served is of some comfort to them. As Amy said, grief doesn't fade. But hopefully, someday soon, this part of the process will be behind them for good.
That's it for episode 22 of All Rise. As mentioned, we will likely return when Josef Puszka's appeal is eventually given a court hearing.
All Rise, the Puszka family trial, was hosted by me, Frank Graney, and produced by Ashley Moore. Follow the podcast on Go Loud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.